publishing houses. Big and small, they are the bookmakers, the ones who work with the authors we love to make their books and dreams come to life. They support writers throughout the exciting and perhaps sometimes terrifying journey of turning their work from a manuscript into a book, to be found on the shelves of our bookshops. Today we will enter the world of a small artisan publishing house in Spain, Sabina Editorial, a publishing house passionate about books well made that talk about the things that matter, and that are written by women. The publishing industry is shifting and adapting, and the role of small independent publishing houses may be changing with it. Many writers are starting to look at small presses first, perhaps preferring the more advantageous contract terms they can offer. Small publishing houses can also be more focused and selective, dedicating themselves entirely to women writers, LGBTQ+ writers, or writers of color. They can, perhaps more than large publishers, enjoy the freedom to take a risk on experimental writing or on a new form of poetry, bringing us new voices or different approaches from established writers. They are essential in keeping diversity in publishing alive. My guest today is Carmen Oliart, one of the women in charge of Sabina Editorial. Carmen has kindly agreed to give us an hour of her time to talk about what she does, what is important for her when deciding to publish a book, and why feminine freedom is a concept we should care about. Hi, Carmen. Welcome to God Books. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
My pleasure.
So before we get into all the questions, could you please tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a publisher since 11 years now. By a marvelous chance, I got to meet Ana Mañeru, who's one of the founders of Sabina Editorial, a small feminist independent publishing house in Madrid, Spain, that only publishes works from women authors. We're kind of like an artisan publishing house. We publish 4, 5 free books, depending on what we get, and are handsome. And this was like a major change in my life just when it had to come. So it was like a magical encounter. And Sabina Editorial actually was founded before in 2007, and they started to publish in 2008, just before the big crisis, with major authors for small publishers. Actually, they started with Clarice Lispector, Tales for Children. That was the first time in Spain that they were published. But we mainly focus on poetry. And also we have a collection of what we call narrative, which is mainly memoirs, essays, sometimes diaries. We have published Virginia Woolf, Mary Shelley in that collection, also a biography from Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, major Spanish language Baroque poet. They were teachers, so they started with sort of essays on education. That material is on our catalog, but we didn't develop it anymore. We also have a collection of biographies for young people, illustrated and also bilingual. We are very serious and very committed with publishing bilingual works whenever the author is not Spanish. We mainly do English-speaking authors because that's the language we know. Also some Italian authors. We are really, you know, put a lot of effort on the rigorous content, rigorous historical work before publishing. Our goal really is to bring out to the world and to the readers the work of women authors that for us are fundamental in the history of literature, in the history of women, and bringing out the part of their life and works histories that have been obliterated, omitted, or changed.
So one thing that I saw on your website is that the books you publish or the motivation behind Sabina Editorial is because you're passionate about books well made that talk about the things that matter. And I was curious to hear from you, what are these things that matter? What are the topics that you focus on? You already mentioned you publish exclusively female authors, so that's something that matters. But what are the topics, the themes? Are there specific things that you look at when deciding what to publish?
Well, being a feminist publisher, what we try to bring out is writers that convey feminine freedom. This is a concept used by an Italian group of feminists in the 70s called the School of Milan, the Library of Milan. We search for something that communicates that free women work that have been in the history for centuries. But sometimes those sources are not available to us. They haven't been taught in school. For example, one of the main reasons when the founders of Sabina Editorial started this was because they were teachers at schools. Both Anna, my actual part, my present partner, we are just two now, but they were more at the beginning, right? And they were lacking all these materials that show the history of women. Full point. We want to convey that, you know, the work from women that have put on feminine freedom. I know there's this kind of literature in the mainstream that's called women literature, women writing. Well, we are out of that. I mean, we specialize in what we know is a small niche, but we want to convey the message as, you know, spread it as far as possible. And that's what we focus on. So it might be a poet, it might be a philosopher, it might be a writer. And we are talking about Virginia Woolf, of course, Adrienne Rich, but also marvelous Spanish language poets, classical and contemporary. Something, there's something there that tells us this is, you know, this is what we want to publish. This is something in her way of writing, something in what she says, puts that little seed there. And of course, we have to like the poetry and we have to like the way of writing. And that's a very subjective and personal criteria.
Of course. So you mentioned Virginia Woolf, you mentioned some classic female writers that we might think of when we think of female freedom, but you also publish contemporary writers. And I was wondering if you could tell us, what are some of the more recently published books at Sabina Editorial? And are there some that you're particularly proud of, some authors that you discovered that you're very, very happy you came across?
That's dangerous because I start talking about my authors and I, you know, I love them all. But there's one main author, and it's a classical one. And I want to talk about her because this is what we're known for in Spain mainly, is that my partner Ana and a collaborator of the publishing house, Milagro Rivera, translated and published in a bilingual edition the whole poetry of Emily Dickinson. And that, for good and for bad, is like the mainstone of Sabina Editorial, what we are known for. Some people disagree, some people agree. And what was different there, and this is to illustrate what we were talking about, that they put her relationship to Susan Huntington Dickinson in the center of it, because as she writes in all her letters and all her poems, her love and her relationship, both literally and friendship and emotional and sentimental, for Susan was a cornerstone of her work. So, you know, that really stirred the waters in the first volume that they published in 2012. And that's a line we've been following. And one of the latest books we published in spring was, for the first time in Spanish, the translation of the love letters from Emily Dickinson to Susan Huntington Dickinson, directly from the manuscripts that can be found in the Dickinson Electronic Archives. And we're just about to publish an anthology of poets, both classical and contemporary, who wrote love poems to women. Because Although supposedly this is now accepted issue, it's not that really so in everyday life. So we mixed Adrienne Rich, Emily Dickinson, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz with contemporary poets in Spain, Galician, two women from Chile. We have a strong connection and a new, very nice connection with Chile, with a group of feminists from Chile that write poetry and essays and so on. That's a new thing we want to explore. And actually we publish in September, very poignant book of poetry by Ángela Neira, who's 40-something, and talks about how we women have to recover our own language, which is dominated by patriarchal language, recover the meanings, recover our own way of speaking and our own way of writing, which already Virginia Woolf talked about in 1924, writing A Room of One's Own. By the way, we have the only translation in feminine, and I'll explain what that is, of A Room of My Own in Spanish from Virginia Woolf. Being Romanian, maybe you know, because in English, the gender in words is not exactly the same as in Spanish, as in Romanic languages, right? Where masculine generic is pretended to be universal and covers both women and men, right? So we don't believe that because we believe there are two sexes and we believe they express themselves in a different way. And if you address me talking to me in masculine, like uno, two, using this kind of masculine suffix, well, you're not talking to me. So what did Virginia Woolf wrote this book, as everyone knows, writing to conferences that she gave in two women's colleges in Cambridge. The main translation to Spanish was made, the contemporary one, was made by Borges, who's a major writer, but who also, of course, talked in as a man in a masculine language. And not only that, but he really missed or erased some passages because he didn't understand them, I suppose. I don't know. Or he thought he was at liberty to do it. So we translated that in a feminine language, meaning when Virginia Woolf talks of herself, she talks in feminine with a feminine una, nosotras, in feminine suffix, right? When Virginia Woolf talks in a feminine context, which all this book is, she addresses the public in feminine, and so on and so forth. When she describes a feminine scene, a women's scene, she talks in feminine. And we try to, this is not an easy thing. This has been a political, it's out in the political arena. Should we, you know, multiply the subject we're talking, you know, feminine, masculine, and neutral every time we talk or we write? So it's not easy to find a way where you don't duplicate every time the subject. The text can be readable and in a beautiful way. You have to navigate, and it's not easy, but as Adrienne Rich said, and every feminist knows, once you see, and what you see is change. So once you see in that way, you cannot stop seeing it in that way.
That's true. You can't unnotice it. And
exactly.
And at the same time, language can evolve if there's, if there isn't yet the formula that we have that is readable and easy to follow, maybe we should invent one.
Well, there are formulas, but it's also a subject matter of political debate.
Of course. Yeah. And you come across this in all sorts of contexts. Like now that I'm pregnant, when I read about babies, for example, the baby's always a boy. You always read, he does this now and he does. And I think, well, I'm going to have a girl. Why isn't this written?
Or whatever. Yeah. can be, if you speak in private or public arena, and it's very easy that you will be mocked at because, you know, in using that double subject or just using feminine for a group of people where women are a majority. Even for women, it's hard to do that. And I've been in meetings or, you know, casual or professional with only women, and they still speak in masculine to refer to themselves. So, you know, by the third time, I just pointed it out. But it's so embedded in our brain, like all this patriarchal structure, and language is the main vehicle for patriarchal domination or any political and social domination. So it's really hard to get out of that box. That's another thing we do in Sabina. So when we work with contemporary poets that we can discuss the work with, we talk to them and suggest ways to change it. And they usually respond very well. Sometimes it's like the first time they put their attention in it. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't realize this.
No, because it's not intentional. No? As you say, it's a pattern that is embedded into our brain since childhood, maybe even before birth. And exactly. This is the language that we're used to hearing. And maybe it even sounds ridiculous to ourselves, or it sounds like we're trying to make a point when we switch to other nouns. This is fascinating. So I like the mission of Sabina Editorial very much. I'm curious to know, what were you doing before working here? Were you a teacher before?
No, I never was a teacher. I've always liked books and loved literature and had a dream of having a bookshop or working somehow in this world. But I did many different things. I was in an international NGO for women and girls' rights. I worked in a bank in the marketing department. I've lived in England and the States and Spain, Madrid, Barcelona. I had two kids and raised them. They're grown young men now. So I did different kinds of things. And then, you know, it happened 8 years or 9 years ago. So now my life is dedicated to Sabina. Yeah. And I'm so happy about it.
It's a good mission.
I mean, this is Women's Link was very important to me, the NGO I work with. And I was in board, right? I was president of the board and so on and so forth. But Sabina Editorial and making books and reading these authors is really the most fulfilling. It's more than a job, you know, it's a dedication.
Yeah, this is what I hear also from booksellers, from pretty much anyone working in books, that it's more than a job, it's more than a career, that it's so intertwined with love for books and with a mission, you know, to bring these books to people, especially when you're a publisher. I mean, as a bookseller, of course, you have the power to recommend the books that you love, that you believe in. Mm. But as a publisher, you're really making them happen.
We wouldn't be, I mean, bookshops are an essential. I love bookshops. And I've learned a lot from booksellers, from the people that work there. We wouldn't be able to do this job without them. So,
of course, goes hand in hand.
We don't believe in Amazon. We believe in bookshops.
And we'll come to that. I would like to ask you about your relationship with bookshops. But first, I want to ask you about what it's like to be a publisher. Because for many, many people, and I would include myself in that category, it sounds like a very exciting job. You have the chance to discover new authors, to promote maybe old authors that you believe didn't get as much attention. You were talking about translations, maybe correcting some translations that you don't think are fair. So these, I guess, are, you know, some of the main aspects of the job and some of the more maybe exciting aspects. I'd imagine there might also be more tedious or boring aspects of the job.
Yeah, of course, like, you know, like running any business, really. I take charge of bills, you know, all the everyday stuff that comes in any business. I also transport books boxes to the distributor. You go to fairs, you take care of all the administrative things.
So and a little bit of everything. Like a small business.
A little bit of everything. I do. We are only two partners. And Anna, who's older than me and one of the founders, she, as I say, and she laughs, she takes charge of the important stuff. And I take charge of that stuff with her, but also of the everyday stuff. You get so frustrated because the books are not in time in the bookshops or in this fair, on the other fair, or because you, right now we are waiting for an international agent permit to get this book out and it's already out of time for the Christmas season. Or you talk to an author and a book is, it's all these timelines that you have to meet. And that because you are dealing with humans and writing, which is a very, you know, the creative process is a very special thing. So there are all these surprises coming when you don't expect them. I used to say as a joke that it's easier to work with dead authors because you don't have to deal with a personal crisis. But it's wonderful to be able to work in the process of making a book with an author. It's really wonderful to watch that process and to be, when they let you be a part of it. And we are very clear about that. If we do not agree with part of the text, or we think there's a way of making them better, or to, we do say, and we do, you know, usually we have excellent results. Usually we don't have problems, but sometimes you get them. Yeah. And sometimes you have to drop a book.
So is that your favorite part of the job, working with new authors and helping
them? It's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah.
Also is discovering either a work from a classical author I didn't know, like we're doing now, one on a visionary, fantastic, feminist North American writer, which has not been published in Spanish yet, from the 60s, the very early 60s, one of the first radical feminists, outstanding mind and a very good sense of humor also. Also discovering a contemporary poet that I love. Yeah, it's all, everything is exciting.
What about the more difficult aspects of the job of a small independent publisher? What are the challenges that you maybe sometimes face?
Being out in the market, being known, putting our books. Sometimes we publish what we think is some marvelous book and you don't get to sell it as you expected. Sometimes we publish what we think is a good book and it goes like, boom. Really, you don't have many clues. I mean, you learn in the process and you think this is easier to sell or this is harder to sell, but this is what we call catalog book, you know, something that goes on selling from 10 years on, like the big books of poetry by, I have one here, like these three volumes of Emily Dickinson's poetry or Virginia Woolf or a Spanish classical poet. It's really hard to put your finger on it, you know, why this is working so well. It's another main part of the market, of the line of work, is to have a good distribution. When I came in Sabina Editorial, they worked with a very big distributor. We were just a drop in the ocean for them. And then I got to meet a woman, a young woman, that just started an independent distributor firm that works with very small publishers like us. 20, 30, and she has a very personal way of working both with publishers and booksellers. And to have a personal contact and to know where our books can be best shown or sell, that is a main factor. So that part of the job, which is very, very important, is essential, is on her back now. She's part of the solution. We have a very close relationship. I can talk to her on a Sunday, or she can call me and say, Carmen, what is happening? This book should be already out. And so I tell her about my life and all the problems I have and why the book is not out already. To keep it at a personal level, even though you reach people you don't know here and in Latin America, readers out there that you don't know, bookshops that you don't know personally, but they know your stuff. To keep it at a personal level is where you have contact is really basic. For me, is a main part of it. and to learn from all these people, because you learn, because we are not very business oriented. That's the truth. That's the truth. I mean, being an artisan sort of enterprise or business, it's means that also we're not very business, and that might be lacking in Sabina.
And how does it work for you, or what is your relationship with the big publishers, with, let's say, the publishers that dominate the world of publishing in Spain? Yeah, the market. Are they the ones that, I'd imagine, you know, if they price books at a certain point, that's how much books cost, right? If they, or how does it work?
In Spain, we have a system which is called fixed price, right? Then you, as a publisher, think of a price. You have a range of prices, right? We are all very much bound by that fixed price. So you cannot change the price once the book is published, except for exceptional events like fairs or holidays discount. And that also implies a minimum range of change. In Spain, mainly two huge groups with international interest in them dominate the market. Then you have medium, big, independent publishing houses with a long tradition. Then you have what we could call small, medium, independent publishing. And then a myriad of very small independent publishing houses like ours. Some of them close, but most of all, they keep coming new ones, like bookshops, like traditional bookshops. Many of them closed during the crisis, the financial crisis, but many bookshops are opening. And what we do is we make very beautiful books. We don't make expensive books, except those big three, because we want to, in, you know, and this is something we've been talking to with Raquel, our distributor, because we want to get to the bigger number of people as possible, but knowing that our niche is small. So we want people to be able to buy the books. For example, in Latin America, you have to charge at different fares because they have higher taxes on books, amazingly. For example, in Chile. In Spain, it's 4%. The tax on the books in there is 19%. So we try to come to a price that, you know, pays for the cost of the book, which is high when you do books on paper and you care for the covers and the papers and the design and everything, but to give us a bit of a benefit, but that doesn't discourage people from buying them. So we are in the mid cheap.
What about bookshops? Since you, as you're saying, you're targeting a niche, but obviously you want to reach that niche as much as possible. Are you particular about which bookshops you want to sell your books in? For example, I know there is a feminist bookshop in Edinburgh, so I'd imagine that kind of bookshop is, you know, the perfect place for you to sell your books.
Of course.
But are you against selling in certain bookshops, or do you want to be in as many bookshops as possible? How does that work?
We want to be in as many bookshops as possible because we know feminist bookshops will have our catalog. But we also love bookshops that have their own criteria, that don't only sell the bestsellers or what big groups are sending them, like bombing them. I mean, book in Spanish is like one of the countries in Europe that publish more titles per year. Bookshops are totally collapsed with new titles every week. There are many bookshops that have a personal criteria where there is a place for publishers like us. With some of them, we have a personal, a long-time personal relationship. When I started in this job, this is one of the things I did in Madrid, visiting bookshops that I liked. Also in Barcelona, I have a very strong relationship with Barcelona, with poets, bookshops, editors, all in a small scale. Bookshops that have a personal touch and are interested in books out of the mainstream. And also our distributor, Librerantes, Raquel, does the main part of that work to find bookshops where our books can be sold and are noticed and are appreciated. We wouldn't be alive without bookshops, and we love bookshops. And I learned so much of just talking to booksellers. When I met Terry and Charlotte, they just had started this bookshop they have now, Desperate Literature, was before them, it was like a secondhand bookshop, one of the few ones that you could buy English literature in English language in Madrid. One day I was walking through this past the street, and I noticed a change in that bookshop. And I came in and started to talk, and we understood each other, and now we're friends, and you know, I participate in things with them. I love to see them. I buy books every time I go. This is one thing I do. I go there to sell my books, and I buy books always when I go into the bookshops. I learned a lot from them in personal way, or how to design a new collection, or how to place a book, or what price I should put on a book, all these kind of things, and personal conversations. And this very very rich world. And I mean, it gives you personal growth, and you know, I really, really enjoyed that.
That's why we love bookshops. And I'm glad you mentioned Desperate Literature. That's also how we met. And they were also featured very early on our podcast.
You met Charlotte?
I met Charlotte. I went to the bookshop in Madrid after I had interviewed her.
Oh, so you came to...
Yes.
Okay.
And she had already described the bookshop so well for the podcast, but then going there and seeing it was such a different experience. It was amazing.
And it's so wonderful. It's amazing in a small space. First, how beautiful it is. The sense of hidden treasures,
yes,
you get
exactly.
When you walk in Desperate Literature.
There's so many corners. It's so small, but there's so many spaces.
Exactly, corners.
Yeah.
And you turn around and you find something. And I love the atmosphere there. And I really like them. It's they're such a nice
people.
Warm
place.
And they really gave me a very warm welcome from the first minute, and we get on very well. So it's a wonderful experience.
And
I recommend it to everyone I know. My kids go, you know, it's,
Since we're on this topic, would you like to share with us some other bookshops that you love in Madrid or in Barcelona or anywhere in the world?
See, in Madrid, quite close to Desperate Literature, it's Enclave de Libros. Like include, like they have a very personal line there. Philosophy, you also find some of them, let's call it bestsellers. They do novels, short story. They have a strong collection of films and photography, theater books. They're keen on anarchism, philosophy, poetry. And that's another one of those very personal bookshops. You go in and you feel there's something different. And it's run by a couple of Italians that have been here. They have been here for ages, and a younger partner. There's also Mujeres y Compañía, feminist reference bookshop in Madrid, which is now in Embajadores, different from La Librería de Mujeres. They're two feminist. Well, there are more than two now, but Mujeres y Compañía is the main one.
I want to ask you a different sort of question now. So many writers, and a few of my friends want to be writers one day, you know, they try to write a manuscript or maybe a short story or poem, whatever it may be, and they wonder what it is that publishers are looking for. So obviously you're very focused, as you mentioned in the beginning of that conversation, on a specific type of writing, on a specific type of literature. But even within that niche, what is your relationship with writers? Do you receive manuscripts and then you decide whether you're going to publish them or not? And what's your process in doing that? What do you look for? So, you know, okay, this is something that we will take on and we will try our best to make it a success.
That's so hard to explain what we look for. There's something very personal. I mean, you have to read and something has to move you. You have to read and appreciate a good writing. Even if it seems easy and simple, has a work behind. something that touches your soul and something that touches your intellect, and in my case, all the things we talked about at the beginning. I receive proposals all the time. I must say, like, one in 50 works. People write, I think people, I mean, it's good to write in poetry or novels. Novels are not our stuff, so that's another fiction. We don't publish fiction, so everything we get in that side, I, you know, answer politely, we don't do this. Everything I get about poetry, most of it add nothing new to what I have, or is very raw and green. It's good that people write, but to get to, I don't want to put labels on it, but to get to write good poetry, you have at once to put your feelings into it and be detached. So you take the language, the instrument you're working with, not only the meaning, to a different level, to a higher level, which takes the reader, in this case myself or yourself, to a higher level that can be universal. This is a very schematic way of putting it. So if you pour your feelings or open your guts, you might be in a soft way or very raw way, you know, like open your guts and pour, you know, vomit it on the paper, I would say work on it. Sometimes I see good stuff, potential, but you have to work and work. And I, you know, when I get to talk personally to with some very young women that are, for some reason, approach me and show me their stuff and say, there's very strong potential here, but you have to write and write and read and read. What happened, there's this ambivalent thing with social media, no? Social nets. One is a very good and easy vehicle to put your stuff online. On the other hand, no one edits, okay? No, you don't have a mediator, and that's a dangerous stuff. Another good point is that many young people are reading poetry. What I think of most of this work out there is that they are mostly songs, nice songs, beautiful songs, but not the poetry I like, or not what I would publish, because publishing is an effort, is money cost, is a lot of things. So what we look for, there's something unexplainable, like I have to see that you write well, that you have personal thing to say, that you touch me in some way, and you convey something, might be personal or might be more general and universal, and it has to be feminine. I'm not saying feministic enough.
Yeah. So the unexplainable, that's what we're looking for.
Something.
A little bit of unexplainable magic is what you're looking for.
See, it's hard. It's like, yeah. What do you like in a book?
Mm. Yeah, it's very difficult.
Well, as a reader, you appreciate a book very well written, but you appreciate other things.
Of course. Maybe you appreciate how it makes you feel, the mood it brings you.
And what tells you about the world and the look on the world that the writing conveys. Not only the story, I mean, I read fiction, right? Not only poetry and essays, of course. You're reading the story and what is happening. And poetry can be read like that, although it's a very synthetic way of writing it. But at the same time, it's taking you somewhere else or speaks from a particular point of view to many different people in many different countries, in many different centuries.
So you mentioned earlier social networks and how authors now, you know, they have this ability, they can immediately put their work out there and have it be liked, not liked, criticized. It's similar with self-publishing, right? That has become so available to people now. Mm. It's not even as expensive as it used to be. So maybe, you know, that's an option. Let's say you're a poet and you're trying to get your book out there. Maybe you send it to a couple of publishers, you get rejected. You could self-publish. You have that option. Mm. So can you tell us a little bit about how this affects maybe the industry overall, but how does it affect small niche publishing houses like yours?
it would be difficult to measure how it affects us, right? And we don't take that into account. What we take into account, and we have a strong opinion on it, and anybody in this industry would say, is editing is necessary. Even if it's just a different look, another pair of eyes looking at your work, right? Like you would have an associate if you're making clothes. I don't know, you know, like this is not well sewn. That color doesn't go with that color. Also, the big groups did get into the social nets, pick different authors, make them, you know, work for them, edited them, and sold them, and they sell really well. So it's a positive and a negative point in that. From a personal point of view, if I were an author, I will have to think if it's more important for me to get to write what I want to write and have, you know, ask for counsel, even if it's your friend, you know, a partner to read your stuff, or I want to be published.
I mean, for many people, it might just be the dream of seeing their work in a book form, right? In the shape of a book and having it on
so
a shelf.
So go and get auto-edited or self-edited. And maybe you get success. Maybe you're successful. What I tell them when I get the chance to have this conversation is, before you do that, work on it. Work on it.
And that's just the first part, right? You have the book published, but then you were talking about distribution, getting it out there to the bookstores. That's something that is much harder to do if you self-publish, I imagine. That's a big piece of the puzzle that you don't have that knowledge.
Most of the bookshops, there are bookshops that sell self-publishing authors, but most of them don't. Bookshops in Spain, it goes like this. You publish a book, you will get 50% of the price of the book as a publisher. The distributor, more or less, right? I'm talking about there are different discounts, but you will pay her, 50%. From that 50%, the bookshop gets 30. So this is the chain and how it works. You can jump over the distribution and go straight to bookshops, but that's a hard job and you won't get very far. If you're an author and you want to jump over all that, you get your full benefit, whatever it is, it will be low. I, as a publisher, pay my authors an agreed percent on each copy sold.
Okay, right? So that's pretty fair.
If you're a big publisher, you are going to publish a best-selling author, you pay them in advance a huge sum or a mid sum or a tiny sum. As we cannot do that, we pay our authors on books sold, each copy sold, 10%.
Okay.
That's how we do it. There are different ways. We don't pay that much attention on how that can affect us in a market level, because then you wouldn't run on this race, right? I mean, I think our relationships, I mean, this is a matter that comes out all the time. What is your relationship with big groups, with the market, and so on? I think it's vital politically, socially, and for our everyday lives that there are different scale of publishing, different scale of writing, different scales for the surviving of a variety, diverse society with diverse voices. This is a political issue. I mean, we do politics with every book we publish. I mean, we keep diversity running on from what we can do from a very little spot. And we don't follow into the big current and we don't, you know, drown in it. You have to be also very clear about that, not to get totally anxious and totally mad and totally unable to do anything because, you know, it's, can I race against a Ferrari? No, I cannot. Or any big runner? No. Can I play like Nadal? No, I can't. I'll play my own court.
Yeah. But it's so important for this diversity to survive, right? If you imagine a world in which we only big publishers, or we only had Amazon as a bookseller, or we only had chain bookstores, then what would happen is that it would always be bestsellers that would be pushed and promoted and nothing else.
We work with a couple of chain booksellers in Spain, Spanish ones. And one is FNAC, which is French origin. Another one is La Central. But we don't work with major chain books, like also sell fridges. And we, of course, don't publish in Amazon. Although you sometimes can find books from our catalog in Amazon because some bookshops use it.
So before I let you go, Carmen, I would like to ask you if you could share some of your favorite books with us, maybe books you've loved for a long time or recent books that you read that changed you in some way.
A book that changed my life. There wasn't one single book that changed my life. There were books. Well, I remember at 13 reading Jane Eyre. That's a landmark. I remember later on reading Clarice Lispector or Cortázar, you know, the Latin Americans or some Spanish. In these last 10 years, I've read authors that haven't changed my life, but have changed the way I see, the way I look at things, and that's major. And those would be some books we worked on that also changed my mind in a way. Well, Virginia Woolf also is one of my favorites, of course. Emily Dickinson, Adrian Rich. Adrian Rich, for me, is one of those passionate, visionary, fantastic writers, both in poetry and essay, that I think put things on writing, like other feminists of that period, that changed the way of seeing and writing for women that write, like Virginia did. But I'm very, very keen on these two books we make in Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz is from the 17th century. She was a rock and roll star of Baroque poetry, was born and lived in what was called La Nueva España, in New Spain, Mexico. She was a prodigious girl. She was very famous there when she was a girl already. I knew her from school, like Baroque poetry is very difficult to read. So I had this notion. And then we discovered this book, The House of the Enigmas, dedicated to the House of Pleasure. This was probably the last thing she wrote. From investigating this, which I will tell very synthetically, came out this biography by Milagros Rivera, is one of our main collaborators who edited this small thing. And this is a kind of poetic biography who goes searching into the deep past of feminine knowledge, like going to the Middle Ages and before, and how she, although she went into a convent like many in her days and before and after, just to live the life she wanted and to write and to read. Then she met and fell in love with the vice queen of Spain, a countess that was in charge when she came back to Spain. She published all her work, but she was known all over. This is a magical book. Really changes, it turns your mind around. This was probably the last thing she wrote, and she wrote it for a group of nuns in Portugal, mostly in convents in and around Lisbon, that had a social literary assembly called the House of Pleasure, because pleasure and reading and politics and even religion, I mean theology, was a political matter in the Baroque epoch, right? And they make a book, they ask through the countess, they ask Sor Juana to write something for them, and she sends them 20 enigmas on love. They make a book, which is replied here, which existed, but there's no more copies left. This we did from manuscripts archived in a National Portuguese Library in Lisbon. They laugh about the power of the king and the power of the church and make their own books. The love enigmas were meant to be talked and discussed and find out about, reading them in groups as they did, reading them from their personal experience of love, diving into Sor Juana lyrical poetry, which is all dedicated to the countess. What we know now about living in a convent, about castity and so on, wasn't the same until the 19th century, which is one of the most misogynist centuries together with the 20th. They were very free women, very powerful, very cultured. So these two books were wonderful to me. The discovery of this manuscript, the making of it, the how it led. We even discovered a self-portrait by Sor Juana, which is this, which is kept in in El Escorial Monastery in the Royal Library, signed by a very mediocre painter of the 18th century who used to copy portraits. But this is hers and came from Mexico with the countess and her books. I mean, it's a wonderful story that led us to many discoveries.
So amazing to go back in time like that and to discover this.
And intellectually very challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these two books can be purchased directly from your editorial if any listeners.
Yeah, we have a webpage where people that doesn't live in Spain can buy our books, and we personally put it on the mail. But you have to read in Spanish. Those two are in Spanish. Our poetry books are in bilingual editions. This is one of our best sellers that we published last year, Adrienne Rich, Galaxies of Women. This is another major basic author to read for pleasure, for inspiration, for political standpoint, from any point of view you want to. I could just put them all here on the table, but...
So these and all the other books you published can be found on your website and people can buy them, and they don't have to be in Spain, right? Anyone in the world can purchase them. They just have to read in Spanish in some cases, but there are many Spanish speakers out there.
Yeah, or English and Spanish if they want to, if they're curious. Yeah. But English, only English authors we have in poetry, and would be Emily Dickinson, Adrienne Rich. This is what we call Collection Minima, which are small books that this collection came out after publishing the big three volumes of poetry by Emily Dickinson. We do selections of poets we love, both classic and contemporary. And some of them are whole books by contemporary authors. Most of them are selections we make ourselves, and we put in a small prologue or introduction to talk about the work. We have three or four on Emily Dickinson by themes for people that don't know her or are not used to read poetry. This collection was thought about like that,
to slowly introduce you into the world.
It's people that are not used to, to have a pick of the authors. And then if you like them, you go to the major works.
Yeah, more and more. Amazing. Well, I will include those links in our show notes for everyone who wants to go and check them out.
Just a link to our web.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, my partner is calling me, but I will talk to her in a minute.
Thank you very much for answering all my questions today, Carmen, and for taking the time to talk to us. And
no, thank you, Antonia. I mean, thank you for the opportunity. And it's wonderful, and it's a very good exercise to talk to someone that it's, not your everyday. But then you have to make an effort to explain what you do, even if you don't make it. It's not easy.
Well, you did it very well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for listening to God Books today. Tune in again next Friday for news from the book world and a book review with a special guest. Until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy a good book.